Hello, I'm Katie Gray and welcome to another episode of Tanfield Talks. Today we learned that the economy shrank by 0.2% in the third quarter of this year, and the Bank of England is warning of the longest recession since the 20s. So in this episode, we're bringing you a recording of our recent panel discussion at our junior property conference, the theme of which was Anticipating Recession, Property Practice in a Downturn. You'll hear from Philip Rainey KC, Michael Walsh and Piers Harrison, all facilitated by Matty Green, answering questions on their experiences of litigating in previous recessions and their thoughts on what we might see in the coming months and years. We pick up the recording where Matty asks, do you think that we'll see the same types of litigation in this recession as we did in the last?
I hesitate to say this, but I suppose I've been dragged along just because I'm very old. Unfortunately, I am, because I was called to the bar during the 1990s recession. So I have lived through at least four property crashes, and they're all slightly different. The 1990s recession was worse because you had, at one point, mortgage rates spiked at 15% for a day, but mortgage rates were very, very high. You had mass repossessions. Not only were the mass repossessions, but actually you were in the same boat that your clients were in, because they're all having terrible problems. And then you're thinking, well, how am I going to pay my own mortgage or pay the rent? So I think all recessions have a slightly different flavor. I think Michael will talk about whether it will be the same again, because you probably won't get the same attitude to repossession that you got in those days, because in the end, the banks lost more money by mass sales than they would have done by hanging on. I think that we can talk about different things, but I think one of the things we could talk about, I'll hand over to Michael to deal with mortgages, but then I think sales contracts and the attitude to pending purchases is probably the next thing to talk about as we go from, whether it was a boom, I'm not sure, but as we go from the up, and I think we're now tipping into the recession, and how your contract litigation will change. But perhaps I'll hand over to, since I mentioned mortgages, I'll hand over to Michael.
Thank you. So I have been through the big crash. So I started practice in 2008, and so came right into it when Lehman Brothers happened, and saw quite a bit of mortgage litigation at that time. There's lots of other litigation that happened in that recession, but one of the things that I remember most vividly is the amount of mortgage litigation. And in that recession, there wasn't a huge number of repossessions. As Philip said, in the 90s, there were a lot more. People basically went to the wall. But in the 2007, 8, 9 crash, people generally didn't. In 2010, so it was just after the worst of it, there were 38,500 possessions in that year, according to what was the Council of Mortgage Lenders and is now UK Finance. So that's quite a lot, but then that sort of tailed off during the middle of the last decade, down to about 7,000 a year, and then really tailing off, of course, during COVID, which I'll sort of come back to in a minute. But I saw more, litigation was more about unraveling the enormous amount of fraud that had taken place in the pre-2007 era. I mean, the amount of mortgages that were given on self-certs, and people sort of saying, oh yeah, no, I definitely earn 100 grand a year, I could definitely afford that. And as they were servicing it, no one cared. But of course, as soon as they couldn't service it any longer because they lost their jobs and the recession hit, that's when the fraud started unraveling. But as some of you may remember, but as some of you may know, the government implemented a huge raft of statutory and procedural interventions to stop people from losing their homes. You know, there's the Mortgage Repossession Protection of Tenants Act as well in 2010. So there were lots of interventions. I don't actually, looking forward, don't see mortgage repossessions being a big thing in the short term. Obviously, we're going to see really high interest rates compared to what we've seen in the last 15 to 20 years. But I think that lenders will be hammered if they go after ordinary homeowners. And we've seen during COVID that the government will just intervene at the drop of a hat to stop people from being evicted. Now, for very different reasons during COVID and for the right reasons. But I think once they do it once, they will do it again. And I could see a lot of government intervention to stop lenders from doing repossessions. Where I think we might see more litigation is in larger developments where, as Philip's already said, people are going to try and get out of contracts. I think we might see a lot more receivership, fixed charge receivership for those developments, large developments, even smaller developments, where the developer is relying on the cash they're going to get in from the purchasers. And that doesn't happen. So the party stops and they appoint receivers. And it's happened, you know, at varying times over the last decade. But I can see a lot more instructions from developers saying, how can I stop this receiver being appointed? Is there a way to get an injunction? What are my options here? And I can see that being a big a growth area of work. But, I mean, I've talked enough now on my own. I'll hand back to Matty to kind of keep us going.
Thank you, Michael. Philip, you mentioned that there's likely to be litigation in relation to large developments and sale contracts. What sort of litigation can we expect? And do you have any tips for those involved?
Yeah, I mean, at risk of sort of war stories, I dealt with one block, and I thought this, you know, the developer must have done really well because they had a 100% failure rate of the contract. So not a single person was able to complete on the completion day. I mean, I imagine it was a terrible development. I think it was an office to resi conversion somewhere in a not very good part of East London, which I won't mention. So it was probably awful, and it was probably all speculation, but literally no one completed in that block. On a more sort of normal note, I acted during one of the recessions for a quite well-known Irish developer, and they had several hundred non-completions on the same development. This kept me going. I mean, I was eventually doing about two appearances a week and doing summary judgments. So I think it's the same litigation you're used to, but it's you're viewing it through the other end of the telescope. So, I mean, for example, you know, you're now looking for any reasons, or the purchasers are looking for any reasons to get out. So you get people poring over the contract. You know, is there any small non-compliance between what the, if it's an off-plan sale, what was promised and what's been delivered? I had one where there had been there were some shenanigans about the floor numbering. So somebody said, if I'd known this was technically, it's not really the 13th floor, it's actually only the 11th floor because you've built another bit of the block which adjusts the floor level. So I'm not really as high up the block, and therefore, if I'd been told that, I wouldn't have bought it. So there's a misrepresentation, therefore I'm not going to complete. You get lots of misrepresentations alleged. Again, war story, I kid you not, someone actually stood and told the High Court judge that they had been promised that the DLR station was going to be moved away from their flat. But people are desperate. They will say anything in this kind of litigation. People pore over the standard conditions of sale because they're incorporated and it's the small print and no one cares. But quite often, you know, it's standard conditions of sale, and then which edition have they incorporated, and then which clauses have they omitted, and does it actually work with the special conditions for the deposit or the interest payments, the notice to complete, is it really triggered? You get that kind of close analysis of the contract. You probably need to get a bit of construction expertise under your belt, because particularly if it's off plan, people will start looking for non-compliances with building regulations. You know, is the ventilation system, you know, in accordance with whatever it should be. I had one where the stairs were not particularly well fitted by the builder. And actually, if the treads on stairs aren't quite right, it is actually dangerous because you can trip. You're going downstairs and one stair is slightly taller than the other. You pitch forward. So this was said to be a terrible non-compliance. It would cost £1 million to rectify all X houses which were being bought in bulk. Therefore, again, you say, well, there's a non-compliance which is material and therefore grounds for non-completion. You get challenges to high deposits. you'll get everybody going back over the how they were sold the property. You know, was there a sales fair? Sales fairs are a complete nightmare because they will say that at the sales fair they were told this, or they didn't sign that, or the contract wasn't put together. You know, was the sometimes they sign a reservation form which has a contract appended to it. Did they sign it in compliance with Section 2 of the 1989 Act? You know, you might have to get forensic about it. You know, hold it up to the light. Can you see that their signature is carboned through? So it's the same litigation, but different. And to finish, because I mustn't talk too much either, how you deal with it is just try and keep everything as standardized as possible. So if you're running litigation, try and use the same claim form or the same defense if you're acting for a group defense over and over again. Don't vary it so that when you get a precedent and the master says this is right or this is wrong, then you've got it in the bank. If you change the wording, it doesn't necessarily work the second time around. If it's the same pleading, you can reuse the same skeleton so it halves your amount of work. If you're running litigation as a solicitor, try and get an informal counsel team together so that when the things come up, if X is not available, you know that Y, the substitute, knows the case equally well. And if you've got all the same pleadings, then it's much easier to chop from client to client. And I think, I know it's a really simple thing, but if you've got a mass claim, don't issue all the claim forms on the same day, because then they'll all eventually all come up. You'll have to do disclosure all at the same time, and you'll have the directions hearings will all be at the same time. You make a rod for your own back, so batch issue them. And then when you get one difficult defendant, settle. So they'll whip up everybody else. So settle with the ones who are difficult.
And settle with the ones with difficult facts.
Yes.
Because, of course, they'll be the test case that all the others will ride on. Can I ask a question to Piers, actually, about contracts that go off? What do you think about getting a deposit back as a purchaser if you don't want to complete under Section 49 of the Law of Property Act?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose the thing to say is be aware of Section 49, because some people aren't. There's a discretionary remedy to recover a deposit. It's very fact-specific. So, you know, if you're acting for the person who can't complete, you need to take that into account.
We'll stick with you, Piers. Whilst you're there, one of the topics we were discussing was commercial lease renewals. What do you think we can expect to see in that sphere?
Well, we're talking about a recession, whether it comes or not. You might have faith in the government to pull us through and their pro-growth agenda, or you might take the market view that it's disastrous. But, you know, whether there's a full-blown recession or not, we're living in times of uncertainty. So in times of uncertainty, people want shorter leases, tenants want shorter leases, they want break clauses so that they've got optionality, so that they can, you know, get out of a... premises if they, you know, they don't want to run them anymore. Obviously, there's arguments about rent, and in a dynamic market when rents are moving quickly, it presents difficulties for valuers because historical comparative sales may no longer be representative. So you also have the opposite that. Well, not exactly the opposite, but when the market's dynamic, it doesn't mean there are lots of deals. Sometimes markets freeze up for a while until they sort of find an equilibrium. No one knows what the right price is. So there's just a dearth of comparables. And the older comparables don't represent what the market is. So there's plenty of scope for disagreement there, which is good for cases going to court. I mean, lease renewals are highly cyclical because they happen all the time, but they hardly ever result in contested hearings. As an editor of Landlord and Tenant Review, we do a digest every 2 months of cases above county court level. And there's very, very few reported cases at high court level or above of contested lease renewals. So they don't happen until, you know, issues like this make it difficult.
What sort of terms do you think parties will start to argue about?
Well, the case I've got to advise on at the moment is, as I've just said, about rent, about break clauses. The tenant wants two in a five-year lease. The old lease was 10 years. They want five this time. Exactly that. They don't want to be tied in for too long. I mean, everyone expects that, you know, things to get worse, don't they? That's why we're having this discussion. And in that situation, you don't want the rent to be set at what the prevailing rents were for too long a few months ago, you know, because you might find that you're significantly over-rented. So that's what people are trying to avoid.
That's also that volatility is feeding into the mortgage market as well, isn't it? I mean, today's average fix apparently is 6.5% for 2 years. You know, what's going to happen next is anyone's guess. It could be that interest rates stay around that level or they drop next year. So people are really having to think, well, what do I do? Do I take a two-year fix? Do I take a five-year fix? In 5 years, I might well be paying a very, very high interest rate because, of course, if inflation drops, then perhaps interest rates will be dropping too. Who knows? I'm not an economist. But if they do start climb further than that, I think that's going to present problems generally for the mortgage market. One of the most immediate questions I'm being asked a lot is, can lenders withdraw offers that they have made? So, as Philip declared an interest, I'll declare an interest too. I'm just about to refix and not quite ready, and I'm hoping that my lender doesn't withdraw my offer. But the answer to that is, well, it's fact-specific. I can't really see the retail lenders, the big banks that are members of UK Finance, really getting into a position where they're starting to withdraw firm offers. Now, I don't know if any of you saw the Question Time clip from a couple of weeks ago where the lady said that her offer had been withdrawn and that she could only get a mortgage of 10%. I'm a bit sceptical about whether that really was an offer. Lots of people talk about offers. Of course, you get an offer in principle, which is, yes, we'll lend to you. You seem to meet the affordability criteria. And then you go through the underwriting procedure, and then you get presented with an offer, which is, yes, we'll lend you the money, and then we'll complete on the mortgage. I think it's unlikely those offers are going to be withdrawn. But that's on a retail level. For larger commercial projects, I think that lenders might be a bit more aggressive with their borrowers. And it all depends on the terms of the offer. So, you know, most retail offers will have five or six bullet points that say, as long as your circumstances don't change, then we'll keep this offer. You might find, actually, as I said, in the more aggressive offers or situations where there's a commercial borrower, that the lenders may say, well, your situation has changed. Your balance sheet is terrible now, and it wasn't 2 months ago. And so we're revoking the offer, and we're entitled to do that under the terms of the offer. So that's why I say I think it's going to be quite fact-specific.
I think that's much more... Sorry.
I was going to say, is that anybody else got anything to add to that? So,
no, I was going to say, with commercial lending, the killer in the recession is the loan-to-value covenant. There's usually hidden away a covenant which says that you've got to maintain cover at X percent, so something like 70% loan-to-value. And if the bank is pulling its horns in and it's just identified a hit list of possible sort of potential problem accounts, then they simply send a value around to your client and then say, oh, sorry, it was worth 30 million, the development, now it's only worth 20 million. You need to find 7 million to top up the loan-to-value back up to 70%, which they may not be able to do, which then obviously triggers either a fire sale or a receivership. And you can have quite interesting litigation about whether those loan-to-value covenants can be triggered, how they should be measured, because the developer will say, but hang on a minute, if you gave me 3 weeks, we'd have got the building topped out, and then it would be worth more than 20 million, etc. So I think that's another, on the commercial front, that kind of covenant is another potential source of work.
The other point to make, of course, is, as Philip said earlier on, lenders are not going to want to take back possession of an enormous number of properties and then sell them into a depressed market. I mean, it's obviously going to, people are saying 30% overvalue in the housing market at the moment. It's not off wide of the mark. And so if the lenders then just take back possession, well, what are they going to do with this housing stock? You've got people, no one really necessarily to buy them. So they'd probably rather just sit on it, which is why I think receivership is potentially going to be something that lenders will look at. They keep people in the properties, more so commercial, as I've said, but I think there may well be more receivership than there is mortgage repossession.
I was just going to say something about how it might be different this time around. So I agree with Michael about government intervention. I think that the genie's out of the bottle there, but even conservative governments are not afraid to intervene. And what happened during COVID is, sort of broken fresh ground. One thing I wonder is whether there might be something related to the number of foreign buyers, mainly tenants, at this time around. So I had a client yesterday who's from Lebanon and was telling me how everyone's money in Lebanon was frozen by the banks, unlawfully as it happened, which is quite an interesting sort of story. You may have seen in the BBC News, someone went and robbed a bank in Lebanon to get their own money out. So whether that's theft or not, some kind of an offence. But obviously, if anyone who had their money in a bank in Lebanon, who had debts in this country, mortgage debts or unable to complete on the contract, they'd have trouble. And then I've got another case where the defendant alleges that because of capital controls in People's Republic of China, they can't pay a debt. So that could be something. Because the number of foreign buyers was staggering in relation to newly built developments in London at one point. The number of foreign buyers was something like 75%, which is extraordinary when you think about it. And I think that market is slightly sort of separated from when you look at the areas of London where these huge residential towers have gone up. Those are the flats that are being bought by mainly foreign buyers. So whether there's sort of dislocation in the market between those developments, things like Battersea Power Station development, which just opened. But that's just speculation.
I think foreign buyers are one of the great imponderables because one aspect of the current recession might be that the pound is extremely weak against a basket of foreign currencies. So you might think, and a lot of developers might think, that there's the rescue market. One of the reasons there are so many flats owned by Far Eastern investors is that in the last recession, the developers took a roadshow, sometimes literally, and sometimes with, you probably know people in the firm who were sent out to Singapore, or Shanghai and so on, to actually take a roadshow. And you do a hard sell to foreign investors. And the reason that you send a solicitor along from the property department is actually to try and get these people to sign up on the dotted line on the day and enter into a LRMPA compliant contract. Now, that might have two effects. One, as Piers says, there might be people who were sold in that recession who now are going to have trouble in the current recession, which might make things worse. Or it might be that the rescue is not available in the current recession the way it was because of things like Lebanon has crashed and the Lebanese pound is worth nothing. There are currency controls in China. China's having its own economic problems. So this great sort of wadge of money which was being transferred out of China may not be available to buy developments in the UK. And if there isn't a foreign market to sell into, it may be that this recession is much worse, actually.
Philip Rainey, Casey, Michael Walsh, Piers Harrison and Matty Green there sharing their experiences. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please join us again next time on Tanfield Talks.